This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. The growing number of people who identify as transgender is raising a lot of interesting and complicated questions about gender identity. The new book, Trans Bodies, Trans Selves, is a collection of essays describing the varied experiences of trans people and the social, political, and medical issues they face. The book was written by and for transgender and gender nonconforming people. As you can probably guess from the title, the book was inspired by the groundbreaking 70s feminist health manual, Our Bodies, Ourselves. Earlier this month, Terry spoke with two contributors, Jennifer Finney Boylan and Aidan Key. Boylan wrote the introduction. She transitioned from male to female and is a writer in residence at Barnard College. For many years, she was a professor of English at Colby College, and her latest book is the memoir, Stuck in the Middle with You. Aidan Key wrote the chapter about gender nonconforming children. He transitioned from female to male and is the founder of the family education and support organization, Gender Diversity. He also co-founded Seattle's Transgender Film Festival.
So, in order to think clearly about transgender issues, I think it's helpful to have the right language. So kind of ask each of you to mention one or two words that you think would be helpful for everybody to know so that they can speak clearly and communicate clearly and understand what transgender means. I think language is very helpful.
Okay. This is Aidan. The language that I typically use in my work world with both professionals and parents who are connected with transgender children. One, of course, is the word transgender. And another one is gender nonconforming. And gender nonconforming is just simply a term that says the expression of that child's gender is different than what society stereotypically expects. Gender nonconforming doesn't mean that a person is transgender. So there's a distinction there, but it's very encompassing in terms of any child with any gender difference, whether that's in identity or in their expression.
Jenny, you had a suggestion?
Well, the word trans is a good one to know just because it's vague. Sometimes you're going to run into someone who's gender nonconforming or gender variant in some way, but not necessarily know how they identify or what their journey is going to be. So something simple and vague like trans is a nice kind of inclusive way of referring to someone before you know more. Another good word to know, and this word is relatively new to me anyway, is cisgender. That's C-I-S gender, which means not transgender. It's worth noting that it didn't seem that this was a word that people knew we needed for a while. We used to just say not transgender, as if not transgender was the norm and transgender was where the trouble came in. But to think that cisgender and transgender are both two different ways of being human that are equally acceptable and fine, I think is helpful because it also helps us to think that transgender people are human and normal and should be defined according to who they are and not in terms of what they're not.
So I'd like to ask you, Jenny and Aidan, some questions about your own experiences as transgender people. Aidan, how did you know that you were trans? Like, what was the first inkling you had? How old were you? What were you experiencing that made you think something, that there was this disconnect between how you thought of yourself and what your body said?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to name a time. The reality is that I was just me. I have an identical twin sister, which I think is relevant to my story. And she and I are alike in many, many ways. And we are also unique in several ways. At some point, I realized that the way I was perceived, the way that I identified, the way I wanted to express myself was something that those outside of me, society, classmates, etc., viewed as different. And I would say my earliest memories, I can bring up examples of that. So,
yeah, give us an example.
Well, this is a little bit older. So let's say 9 years old. I was raised in a born-again Christian household. And this was a day I was attending church, and I was required to wear a dress. I finished with Sunday school. There's the interim period before the regular church service starts. And because I feel so awkward and frankly exposed in a way that's even challenging to describe to others today, I was doing my best to fade into the woodwork until the church service started, and then I could get out as fast as I could afterwards to change my clothes. So I'm in between this Sunday school service and the church service, and I'm looking around at all the people in the lobby, and there are couples with families, and I have my first awareness that I'm supposed to grow up, get married, have a family. And at that moment, I understood clearly that I wanted to get married. I wanted to have a family. I did not want to be the mother. I did not want to be the wife. I wanted to be the father and the husband. I also knew at that very same instant that this was not something that I would articulate out loud to anyone else, including my closest friend, my twin sister. I already knew at 9 years old that there was no cultural context for this, that no one would understand. I'd never heard anyone make some reference to feeling this way.
Jenny, what was your experience with the body of a boy feeling that you were a girl? When did you start experiencing that?
Yeah, as Aidan said, it was something that I was aware of very early. It's one of my earliest memories. I was probably about 5 years old. My mother was ironing some shirts of my father's, and I remember she said something like, "One day you'll wear shirts like these." And I remember thinking, "What? Why?" And almost simultaneous with that, I remember thinking, I'm supposed to grow up to be like my father? Really? And as Aidan said, almost simultaneous with that insight was the companion insight that it was something that I'd better keep private. Now, it's probably worth noting that when you're a child, you don't have a very specific sense of the differences between boys and girls. I mean, not really. It's pretty vague. So that sense of difference is something that also evolved and changed over time. Adolescence was particularly painful. My memory of adolescence was seeing all of the girls that I knew become young women. And for me, I remember thinking that it was like being on a dock watching the ship sail away with everyone like me on it and thinking that I'm left behind.
And you didn't tell anybody about your feelings?
No, I didn't tell anyone. The first person that I had a conversation about was a psychologist in New York after college. So I was into my 20s. And of course, the first psychologist that I talked to knew less about what it meant to be trans than I did. And so, in fact, he not only gave me information that was not helpful, he gave me information that was wrong and that in some ways delayed my being able to solve or to address my troubles by years. I think that's one of the things that trans bodies, trans selves is trying to push back against. For years, the information that was out there was generally information that was known by trans people and not known by the people who are supposed to be in charge of helping them.
As the book Trans Bodies, Trans Selves points out, not everybody who identifies with a trans wants to go through gender reconstructive surgery, or even some people who do just do part of it and not all of it. Can I ask you each whether you felt you wanted to physically change your body, or whether just identifying and dressing and, you know, having people identify you as the gender you thought you were, was that sufficient?
It's a difficult question to answer because there can be some hypotheticals. Well, what if we lived in a society that really did fully receive us for who we are, who we say we are? If we were able to communicate that to someone else and they had a frame of reference for that and incorporated that into how they viewed us moving forward, it might mean that some physical changes are less urgent. But for me, there was some desire to have physical changes, just as I was not interested in having some physical changes when puberty hit. There was definitely no interest in having breasts, for example, When they showed up, I thought, well, it's all over. The future has been set. And the nice thing about physical transition is that there are some ways that we can change that and get ourselves more aligned with exactly how we feel.
So you decided to have some surgery.
I did.
And I should point out, I've seen pictures of you. You're at a studio in Seattle. I'm in Philadelphia, so we're not face to face. I've seen pictures of you. You have a beard.
It's a fact.
And can I ask? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's a funny question. Is it a question? What is your question about that?
What is my question? Yeah, what did you need to do in order to be able to grow a beard?
Let my body interact with testosterone, and it does its thing. Chest hair comes too. You can't see that so much over on a photo, but yeah, my body changed. I would say that within starting my hormone regimen that I gained 15 pounds in a couple months, just muscle growth, energy level increased, facial hair, body hair, et cetera, increased. My voice changed somewhat. So there are some physical changes that testosterone affects, just as it does anyone who produces it. Women and men have testosterone in varying levels, and we see all the ways that works on the body.
So when you started acquiring more male characteristics physically, did you feel more at home in your body, that you were in the place that you were supposed to be?
Absolutely. But one thing I'd like to say, even less so than the physical manifestations, was the relief I felt. It was coming home, so to speak. I felt finally that the way that I was responding, the way I was engaging in life, the way I felt in myself, finally fit. And I don't know how to articulate it much better than that, but it did feel like a finally, here I am.
Jenny,
can I chime in on that?
Yes, please.
I felt something very similar, which is that sense of being at rest, being at peace. So estrogen had a profound effect on my body, and in some ways nearly the reverse of the things that Aidan was just describing. But none of those changes were the changes that were most important. The biggest change was the ability to wake up in the morning and not to have to think about it. When I was a guy, I'd wake up in the morning and I'd think, oh my gosh, I've got to go through this again. I've got to put on this whole show. And it was demeaning and exhausting most of the time. And now I wake up in the morning and what I have in some ways is the thing that most cisgender women have, which is the ability to wake up in the morning and not to have to worry, oh my God, what gender am I going to be today? I mean, the other big change for me was also going from a person who had a secret to a person who didn't have a secret. And in some ways, that was a more profound change than anything else that happened physically.
We live in an era where, in a lot of places, you can really wear whatever you want. And a lot of women who aren't, you know, cross-dressing, dress in the same way men do, jeans and a t-shirt and a jacket. And a lot of men wear variations on jeans and t-shirt and jacket. So you could kind of dress the same as either gender. What changes did you make in your clothing when you started assuming the gender that you identified as?
Well, early on, I went through a phase, and this is somewhat typical of some transsexual women. I went through a phase where I kind of had a second adolescence. I was very youthful for a 40-year-old. and, you know, I wore kind of stretchy T-shirts and skirts and things. And it was very trying for the people who were around me, I must say. But once I kind of got that out of my system, because, I mean, it really was like, you know, something that had been caged up for years and years and years, and suddenly I was let loose, you know. There really was this tremendous sense of release. But once I got past that, I kind of did wear jeans and T-shirts and flannel shirts like everybody else in the state of Maine, which is important to note because, for me, ultimately, it was not about clothes.
Well, the ironic and, to me, often confusing thing is if somebody is transitioning from male to female and in their female identity, they start wearing like heels and skirts and things like that. I'm thinking, in some ways, that's very gender stereotype behavior that, you know, girls wear heels and skirts. And at that point, it starts to get baffling. Like, what is gender? You know, like, what doesn't mean to be a woman? Does wearing heels mean that you're a woman? I mean, does being a woman mean you're supposed to wear heels or skirts?
Yeah, I should hope not. And I would say that of the trans women that I know who've gone through transition, those who've had the softest landing, who've succeeded in that transition, are generally the ones who were feminists before, when they were men. Well, actually, I should be careful with that phrase, when they were men, but before transition.
Yeah.
If you were male-bodied before transition and you identified as a feminist, the odds seem to me much more likely that you will know the world that you're joining. You understand what it is you're going to be up against, because you can't build a life around stilettos and sponge cake. So any person who goes through transition thinking that being a woman is a big gender party is probably in for disappointment.
So, Aidan, let me ask you, when you transitioned from female to male, what kind of changes in your outer appearance did you want to make when your physical body conformed more to your identity, to your sense of identity?
Not much. You know, I really wasn't interested in having breasts. Those went away. And I actually loved having long hair. But one of the things that I found is that as I transitioned to male and more people were perceiving as male, is that long hair sent a different message. I got a lot of dudes and bros and are you in a band and things like that. And I found that people didn't take me seriously. So I opted to cut my hair. That was a compromise that I made. Like, okay, my authentic self would love to still have my long hair and flip it over my shoulder, but I weigh out the repercussions of that, and I'm not going to advocate for all the men in the world who wish to have long hair and try to make that a better experience. I've got enough on my plate in terms of my world-changing activities. So instead, I compromise and cut my hair. As far as clothing, I wear the same clothes.
Which is
that's
what?
That's one of the blessings of the latitude that women have in our society, is that we can wear the jeans and the t-shirt. So, yeah, I just wear clothes that I'm comfortable in. The translation of my presentation, however, is quite different. If you think about kind of a more masculine expressing woman with jeans and a t-shirt and whatever, I came across as working class, probably lesbian. The masculinity was there. So that sends a certain message to people, and they engage with me in a certain way based on what they perceive. So now my presentation is, well, I'm white, I'm male, I come across middle class, educated, and it allows my voice to land in different ways than it used to. It allows me a freedom of movement that I didn't have before. My wife and I, even, we moved to a new neighborhood, and we felt a little stymied and stunned by the fact that everybody was really open and welcoming when we first moved there, rather than in my previous experience where if we're perceived as a lesbian couple, folks were not necessarily unkind or rude, but definitely more standoffish. So my wife affectionately refers to it as the wind tunnel of heterosexual privilege.
So you mentioned you're married to a woman. Were you together before you transitioned to male?
No.
And so can I ask, do you think of yourself now as straight or lesbian? I assume you're going to say you think of yourself as a straight man now. But I don't know what you're going to say.
So. Yeah, I'm not sure what I'm going to say here, because I absolutely don't view myself as lesbian. That implies female. You know, honestly, I love my gender, and I feel like it's a bit of both. My presentation is male, so I identify as male in the world for most conversations that I have. But when I get to know somebody a little bit more, I talk about the fluidity of gender, and that, you know, I never felt female, and I don't fully feel male. And I'm not sure whether that's my innate sense of myself or just because of my experience, my socialized experience in life. But I do feel at peace and at ease with who I am. And when people say, ask me questions about my gender, I say, I've got a lot of it.
Okay, well, that's good enough. Jenny, when you were physically male, and help me out with the language here, when you were physically male, you were married to a woman, and you stayed married after you transitioned to female. So
yes,
do you think of yourself as having... go ahead.
We celebrated our wedding anniversary 2 weeks ago. We've been married for 26 years. I think it's been 12 as husband and wife and 14 as wife and wife.
So the book Trans Bodies, Trans Selves, to which you both contributed chapters, points out that, you know, gender and sexual orientation are different issues, and people identify differently with them. So when you changed physically, did you feel like you changed sexual orientation while staying married to the same woman?
There was a time right after transition, kind of the when womanhood was all new, when I wasn't quite sure where I was. I felt kind of bewildered a little bit. But the woman that I'm married to, who is named Grace in the books that I've written, including the memoir She's Not There, but whose real name is Dee Dee. Dee Dee has always been the center of my universe, and I've always been attracted to her, and I'm still attracted to her. And so I guess I was a straight guy, sort of, back in the day, and I guess now we're a lesbian couple, but we're the same people, and we still love each other the same way.
I want to thank you for doing this and for being so open with us. Thank you very much.
It's been wonderful.
My pleasure.
Aidan Key and Jennifer Finney Boylan speaking with Terry Gross earlier this month. Boylan wrote the introduction to the new book, Trans Bodies, Trans Selves, and Key wrote the chapter about gender nonconforming children. You can hear the full interview on our website, freshair.npr.org. The Beatles first reached America in February 1964. By the time their film, A Hard Day's Night, came out here on August 11th of that year, they had become an unprecedented phenomenon. Richard Lester's film has just received a new digital restoration in 4K resolution, and to honor its 50th birthday, is being released in theaters as well as on disc. Our critic at large, John Powers, has seen the spruced-up version and says it's easy to see why it became a cultural landmark.
Back in 1964, movie audiences were treated to three hit musicals. Two of them, Mary Poppins and My Fair Lady, won scads of Oscars. But it was the third that announced the future. And it did so from its opening chord.
It's been a hard day's night.
What followed from that chord was what we call the 60s. To celebrate the 50th anniversary of A Hard Day's Night, there's a spectacular new restoration that you can now see in theaters in its Janus Films release, or buy on DVD and Blu-ray from the Criterion Collection. The black-and-white photography is so gorgeous, you'll swoon. The movie's not half bad either. It was directed by Richard Lester, a filmmaker as underrated as he was influential. Lester took what was designed to be a promo film for the Beatles, and along with screenwriter Alan Owen, crammed it with ideas from the French New Wave, and his own slapstick short, The Running, Jumping, and Standing Still film, which is on the DVD. The result is a pop artifact that still crackles with freshness and energy. In Lester's verite hyperkinetic approach to the musical sequences, and boy are the songs good, you'll find the template for a million later music videos. The movie's title came from a malapropism by Ringo Starr that, in its paradoxical poetry, felt as inevitable as a folk saying. It fit perfectly a film that purported to capture a typical day in the life of the Beatles, who spent 87 minutes singing, clowning, hanging around a TV station, and crucially, fleeing hysterical fans. You see, this isn't just a movie about rock stars, but about rock stars playing themselves in a movie that's riffing on rock stardom. Of course, even as the Beatlemaniacs sob and shriek, one of the movie's conceits is that people over 30 don't get it. Here, the four are joined in a train car by a stuffy, blimpish, mustachioed businessman who closes the window they've just opened, and when they turn on the radio, clicks it off.
Then we'll have that thing off as well, thank you. But an elementary knowledge of the Railway Act would tell you that I'm perfectly within my rights.
Yeah, but we want to hear it.
There's more of us than you. We're a community, and charity votes up the workers and all that stuff.
Then I suggest you take that damn thing into the corridor, or some other part of the train, where you obviously belong. Give us a kiss.
Watching A Hard Day's Night today, our perceptions are shot through with historical awareness. The Beatles now seem astonishingly innocent in their neat suits and ties. And it's hard not to laugh at how the older characters harrumph at their long hair and cheekiness. For the boys are lovable mop-tops, well-scrubbed, unprofane, decidedly non-threatening. They're so spiffy that in these days of hip-hop and piercings, parents might be delighted to have such nice young men for their sons. Yet the harrumphers weren't wrong. As that businessman on the train somehow grasped, the Beatles and their followers were taking over the cultural train. A Hard Day's Night brims with Marx Brothers irreverence, if not anarchy. And like the brothers, each Beatle has a clear persona. John's the barbed, ironical one who carries himself like a pop genius. Paul's the handsome, nice guy you wouldn't guess was a pop genius. George is the dark horse, the quiet young one with secrets. And Ringo, the most popular back then, was the gentle, sad-eyed one. In hindsight, such personas almost predict their destinies. Even as Ringo is still having a laid-back good time into his 70s, Paul now revels in his living landmark status. He's now photographed hanging out with Warren Buffett. With his hit records, mysticism, and humanitarian work, George would become the triumphant dark horse before dying at 58 from cancer. As for John, if any of the Beatles was fated to be murdered, it was always him. He was the lightning rod. But all this would come later. A few months before A Hard Day's Night opened, the Beatles had landed in an America shattered by the Kennedy assassination not even 3 months earlier, an America yearning for something alive and optimistic. The band was the ideal antidote to such grief, for the Beatles themselves had risen from an even longer, deeper darkness, the shabby funk of a post-war, post-imperial Britain with a calcified establishment, a frustrated working class, and little future to offer the young. In the unmistakable alchemy of their sound, and in their authentic laughter as they run from shrieking fans during the film's opening credits, the Beatles embodied the hope and vitality the world was looking for then, and still loves to this day. Like Louis Armstrong, they created music that, even when sad, is bursting with joy. All those Hard Day's Nights paid off. For more than any band I can think of, they captured the yeah, yeah, yeah of happiness.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the new 50th anniversary restoration of A Hard Day's Night. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you, yeah, 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 yeah.
You think you've lost your love? Well, I saw her yesterday, yeah. The two she's thinking of. And she told me what to say, yeah. She said she loves you.
Coming up, a story about Nazis, typhus, body lice, and the Polish scientist Dr. Rudolf Weigel. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David B. Cooley, in for Terry Gross. When Germany invaded the Soviet Union in World War II, Nazi commanders had another worry besides the Red Army: the disease of typhus. Epidemics of typhus, which is transmitted by body lice, killed untold numbers of soldiers and civilians during and after the First World War. As World War II raged, it reappeared in war-torn areas and in Jewish ghettos, where cramped, harsh conditions were a perfect breeding ground for lice. Our guest, Arthur Allen, has a new book called The Fantastic Laboratory of Dr. Weigel: How Two Brave Scientists Battled Typhus and Sabotaged the Nazis. Dr. Weigel was employed by the Nazis to produce a typhus vaccine. His technique involved raising millions of infected lice in a laboratory and harvesting their insides to get the materials for a vaccine. What's remarkable about the story is that Weigel's lab actually sent weakened, ineffective vaccines to the German army while smuggling the real product to Jews in a Polish ghetto. Weigel also sheltered Polish intellectuals and resistance fighters from the Nazis by employing them as lice feeders, which we'll hear about in a few minutes. Arthur Allen has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, Science, and other publications. He spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Tuesday.
Arthur Allen, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start by just talking about the disease typhus. Now, this is distinct from typhoid fever. That's completely different. Tell us about typhus. What were the symptoms of the disease, how it affected its victims?
Typhus would begin with a terrible headache and back pains leading to fever, vomiting, nausea, diarrhea. Around the time the fever began, there would be a rash that often broke out on the abdomen that was described as looking like little red jewels. It was a petechial rash. And eventually, you would have deafness, you know, terrible hysterical fits of laughter and tears, and sometimes suicides would happen when people jumped out of their beds and jumped through windows or ran downstairs. And sometimes the long-term effects could include things like loss of limbs. People were known to have, you know, lose toes and fingers or a penis.
From gangrene, right?
From gangrene, yeah.
And tell us how typhus is spread and what conditions create a typhus epidemic.
So back in the day when everyone was carrying lice and they were as much a part of our armature as our clothes, typhus could happen in a number of different places where people were wearing their clothes and didn't change them. And that could be in England and the United States, many countries. But basically, when you look at the sort of starting in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when people start bathing, it became a disease that was really associated only with these very extreme situations of war, concentration camps, barracks, ghettos, places where people really didn't have running water, didn't have access to changes of clothes, and then it spread, you know, very quickly in these kind of environments.
And that's because the disease is transmitted, I guess, exclusively by body lice, right?
Right. I mean, the kind of typhus that we're talking about is spread only by body lice, and the body lice live in clothing. They actually live in your clothing, and then they go to your skin and bite you and then retreat to your clothing. So if you don't have clothing, there are no body lice.
So give us a sense of the scale of typhus epidemics in history, particularly in around the turn of the century and in World War II and World War I.
So in World War I, you had a terrible typhus epidemic in the Balkans that began in the Austrian army, which probably picked it up from civilians in Serbia. And then the Russians, typhus was always endemic to Russia, and Russian soldiers brought it to the Eastern Front. The Germans managed to keep it pretty much out of their forces through de-lysing and other measures. But then following World War I, when there was this terrible chaos all over the Eastern Front, after Lenin pulled his troops from the Eastern Front and Russian soldiers were roaming through all parts of Russia, what's now Russia, Ukraine, Belarusia, and there were POWs in Poland, and the disease just spread like wildfire through that entire region. And there have been estimates of as many as 20 million cases of typhus and, you know, 3, 4, 5 million deaths. Nobody knows. The records are terrible. But the reports of eyewitnesses from that time are just staggering and hard to even fathom.
So as World War I ends, it's understood that body lice transmit the disease, but there's no vaccine. And that brings us to the central character of your book, Rudolf Weigel. Tell us a little bit about him.
So Weigel was actually an ethnic German born in what's now the Czech Republic. And Weigel identified himself always as a Pole. And he studied in Lviv, which is now Lviv. He studied zoology and started developing this expertise initially as an entomologist and then as a typhus expert.
Right. So, and he was in the city now called Lviv, which is in this area of Galicia, which was in eastern Poland between World War I and World War II. He was an army doctor, I guess, during World War I, and then set up a lab because he wanted to study lice. When Rudolf Weigel wanted to study lice, he had a problem, which is that lice, once that they are themselves become carriers of typhus, the disease kills the lice themselves. And so he needed a way to get a supply of infected lice. He had a fascinating solution to this problem. Tell us about that.
So bacterial diseases in those days were usually cultured in sort of broths, but you couldn't grow typhus germs that way. And the only animals that carried typhus were humans and lice. So Rudolf Weigel figured out that what he needed to do was to learn how to grow typhus in lice, but in a controlled way. And he was a terribly clever sort of technical wizard who could invent all kinds of little machines. Some of the microscope devices that we use today were he invented, like a secondary focus knob on a microscope. And he invented a way to inject a tiny droplet of typhus germs into a louse through its anus using a tiny sort of micropipette that he would draw out, a glass pipette that he drew out in a Bunsen burner, and he was able to demonstrate that he could inject the germs into an individual louse this way while looking at the louse and the pipette under a microscope.
Yeah, so some people will infect guinea pigs or mice. This is a guy looking through a microscope at an individual louse and right. injecting it with the typhus. And he does this again and again and again to create an infected colony that he can study.
Right. And that's the only way to do it, because lice don't spread it amongst themselves. They only spread it by picking it up from a human. So he had to inject it into each of these lice. And eventually he devised these machines, which would use a sort of a hydraulic pump that you stepped on while you were looking at the louse under a microscope, and it would inject a droplet into a louse, and you could go down a row of lice that he would set up in a clamp with their little louse butts in the air and inject the typhus germs into each of like 50 lice in a row. It's just sort of an amazing contraption, and the whole idea is very surprising.
And it gets weirder as we proceed, but he faced another problem. In order to maintain this colony of lice, he had to feed them.
Right. So the way to feed lice is to give them humans to feed on. And he developed these little sort of matchbox-sized cages. He would put the lice into the cage and put a sort of a little screen over the cage that was a wide enough mesh for the louse to stick its little needle through, but narrow enough so the louse couldn't escape. And people would strap a number of these cages to their legs with a rubber band and the lice would feed on their blood for about an hour. If you let lice feed for more than an hour, apparently they blow up. So you don't want to do that. But this is how he would keep this colony alive.
So this is the period between the world wars in the 1930s, really. And word gets out that Weigel is making progress towards a typhus vaccine. And what's fascinating is that the way he would produce the vaccine in the lab was this very painstaking process of growing this colony of infected lice and then harvesting the disease and pulling out the proteins. You want to just describe how that happened?
Right. So it would start by injecting typhus solution into these lice serially. He'd put them in something that became known as the Weigel clamp, which held the little lice in place while they were injected with this hydraulic pump. Then they would feed on people. And then after about 5 days, they would be taken and dissected individually. They had to pull the louse gut, which is where all of the typhus germs grew, pull it out under a microscope and put it in a little pot, and then that would be ground up and basically killed. The typhus germs were killed with formalin or some other chemical solution, and that was the vaccine.
So thousands and thousands of lice had to be—
Millions of lice.
So millions of lice had to be injected with this stuff by somebody, pumping them full of the typhus vaccine. Once they died, taking their guts out very carefully, again, each of them done under a microscope by somebody, and then the vaccine was created.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, it was an amazing process. And very labor-intensive.
So Rudolf Weigel develops this lab, begins growing lice by the millions, having them feed on humans who strap little cages of lice to their legs, and then a vaccine is developed. And then war comes. Poland is invaded by Germany in 1939, and the city he's in, now known as Lviv, is at first occupied by the Soviets because there was the, you know, the Hitler-Stalin pact, and then eventually the Nazis, as the Nazis then invaded Russia. Tell us how Weigel himself considered the question of whether to work for the Germans.
Well, I think that Weigel was a very perceptive guy, and he saw that the Nazis were going to invade. And by the time the Nazi invasion occurred, he was looking for the best way to deal with the situation. And he, you know, considered fleeing. He considered suicide. And he decided that he would keep running the lab. And it's a little – there are no diaries that show exactly what he was thinking, but he turned out to have developed a relationship probably by mail with a German army commander named Eyer, who had been stationed in Krakow and was making a vaccine from 1939 to 41 that was very similar to Weigel's. It followed Weigel's recipe. And so when Eyer came to Lviv and Weigel saw that he could work under Eyer, and that he would be able to run the laboratory the way he wanted to, and to hire all of the people he knew from Lviv University and their students and other people who were in desperate need of help, he decided to keep it open. And this would cost him, in the future he would be called a collaborator. But he made the best of a bad situation. He decided that all these people in Lviv were in danger of being killed. The Nazis killed intellectuals. The Nazis killed anyone who was educated and represented another culture. And so Weigel made this very difficult decision that he would make this vaccine for the German Wehrmacht, the German army, but he would do so on his own terms.
That's a fascinating part of the story, because we have a situation where Weigel has this laboratory open, and it's a labor-intensive process. He needs a lot of people to feed the lice. He needs people to dissect the infected lice to create the vaccine. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what kind of people he employed in the lab and what they did.
Well, during the interwar period, all the intellectual life in Lviv was in the cafes. Well, the cafes were all closed during the Nazi occupation, or only Nazis went there, or collaborators. And all of the intellectual life basically migrated to Weigel's laboratory. And people would go in there. There were mathematicians, tables full of mathematicians, who would be doing their work as mathematicians while lice fed on their blood in these cages. There were geographers, poets, all kinds of biologists, you know, every kind of walk of life. But in particular, there were many university professors and students who worked there. There were also people from the Polish underground who worked there. It was a perfect cover to be an underground organizer, because you had this pass that said Typhus Institute on it. You showed that to a Nazi SS person, and on the one hand, they were terrified anyone having to do with this Typhus Institute could be infected with typhus, was dirty, was associated with Jews and lice and typhus. And on the other hand, they were told not to bother these people because they were making a product that was key to the German health defense.
So there was this typhus epidemic raging in the Jewish ghetto in Lviv. Mm-hmm. And you write that at least 30,000 doses of Weigel's vaccine actually found their way into people in that community. How did that happen?
Well, it was smuggled in various ways. But one method that Weigel had for doing this was to tell his bosses that they needed to do some experimental work with the vaccine to make sure that it was up to snuff, that it was working well. And so this would be a pretense for bringing it into the ghetto and vaccinating people. So this went on throughout the war. And there were also thefts of the vaccine and a black market in it. It was one of the most valuable black market commodities because it was thought as being one of the only ways you could save yourself from typhus in the ghetto. A single, you know, dose of Weigel's vaccine could be worth as much as a month's wages or more.
So while Weigel kept his lab open, he made sure to employ persecuted groups such as intellectuals and as well as members of the Polish underground in his lab, working as feeders. And he also made sure that thousands of doses got to the Jewish community in the city. Now, he was employed to produce a vaccine for the German army. Did he? Did he give them vaccine that would work to help inoculate German soldiers?
Yes, he did. And, I mean, his boss, Hermann Eyer, estimated after the war that he might have saved the lives of 10,000 German soldiers. And there was a certain amount of sabotage that went on in the lab where the doses of the vaccine that were headed for the Eastern Front were sometimes weakened, or they would use fewer louse guts to make them, which made them weaker. But in general, I mean, this was legitimate vaccine that did go to protect their enemies. And, you know, this is a conundrum and a paradox that's unavoidable.
And just to clarify, you said that some of the vaccine that was sent to the German army was weakened. Was that Weigel's policy, or was that done by others there, or is it not clear?
Weigel was this perfectionist who was always thinking about his vaccine. And in a way, he wasn't always focused on the current situation, but his associates were. And they looked the other way or were actively involved in a lot of sabotage of the vaccine. Weigel himself was involved in the smuggling operations of getting it to Jewish ghettos and to resistance fighters. But in terms of weakening his vaccine, it's not clear that he would have wanted to do that, even as paradoxical as that is.
Well, Arthur Allen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Arthur Allen spoke with Dave Davies last Tuesday. Allen's new book is called The Fantastic Laboratory of Dr. Weigel. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.